This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. We seem to accept that we are not going to be told ahead of time what a doctor's visit or a surgery is going to cost. But now there is this group called the Free Market Medical Association that wants to try this radical idea of publishing a price list, in essence, a medical menu. And Dr. Martin McCary, who is a professor of surgery at Johns Hopkins, has studied this operation. First of all, I hadn't heard of this association. So these are just a group of private providers who want to deliver health care in their own way?
Yeah, that's right. It's a grassroots movement of physicians that are saying, hey, we can be more honest with our pricing.
Wow. Okay, so you wanted to study these to find out whether this was actually a profitable way of doing business. So how did you conduct your research?
Doctors out there and medical centers have been wondering, if we publish our prices, are we going to get backlash? Are we going to lose business? Are insurance companies going to get angry? Are patients going to be attracted to fair pricing and transparent pricing? What we found in our research study at Johns Hopkins is that of the centers in the United States that decided to make their pricing totally transparent, and that's the actual price, mm-hmm. not some sticker price that then gets negotiated down in some haggling game, but the actual price, it's actually what Americans want. And those centers were rewarded with higher volumes, higher revenues, more contracts with employers, and higher patient satisfaction.
Now, is there some reason that the non-free market providers, couldn't they just initiate this all on their own and just say, hey, as of Monday, by golly, we're going to just reveal to you the price of your surgery?
Absolutely. And that's the situation a lot of clinical centers, mostly the smaller ones, are asking right now is, should we go ahead and do this and respond to the market demand? So for the first time ever, we're seeing a market where people want to know the price. And so doctors groups are getting together and there's a groundswell. It's the most exciting thing I've seen in healthcare in the space of policy and reform. As long as I've been a doctor, you've got the Free Market Medical Association, the Texas Free Market Medical Association, patientsusa.com. You've got these people calling for transparency to make medicine honest, as its mission has always been.
And you're saying the patients are on board with this, but I thought that most patients would find it pretty scary, the idea of paying for their own medical procedures. That's why we had to get the medical insurance, because some of these procedures, I mean, when I remember the first bone marrow transplants came out, $100,000, that's what, 2 years' salary for some people. Nobody would even consider paying full price for that.
Well, there's no doubt that healthcare costs are completely out of control and people are getting crushed. Try starting a small business in America now. I mean, you talk to some of these folks on your radio program. Paying $100,000 a year in healthcare just for three employees.
Yeah.
I mean, most people don't see the massive hikes in healthcare because they think their employees are paying for it. Well, guess what? The employees are paying for it. That comes from the pool of wages sure. and benefits that's allocated to employees. Medicare doesn't pay for things. It's tax dollars that pay for things. So we're getting hit from so many angles now that this healthcare bubble, if it's not reined in, is going to kill small business in America. And right now, people are dealing with these high healthcare costs by having to pay out of pocket. That is, insurance companies trying to manage the high cost of healthcare are simply passing on these high deductibles and copays. So people want to know what something costs. I mean, imagine going to a supermarket and looking at the price of an orange, and there's no price tag. And when they ring it up, they tell you the orange is $5,000.
Yeah.
You'd say, put it back. But in healthcare, you can't. And it's a completely incompetent marketplace that does not follow the same rules that govern any free market.
Right. Well, that's the difference. If you go and you see a $5,000 orange, you say, I'll buy an apple instead. But if we're talking about cancer surgery, your life is on the line. So yeah. So what do these free market medical centers do when you come in and it turns out you've got a breast tumor or something? You can't just pay out of pocket for that. What do you do?
Yeah, good point. And you know, 30-40% of all healthcare in the United States is not predictable and it's not shoppable. I mean, when you get shot in the chest, you can't get a price for that. When you have a very complex case, like the types of operations that I do as a surgeon at Johns Hopkins, some of those things are, you can't put a price on it. But 60% of healthcare in the United States are highly shoppable services. These are clear-cut, definable services. And people are asking for prices, but the medical centers are not providing them, partly because they don't know what they are. They've never had to price it out. And partly because the lack of transparency in the system has, quite frankly, made a lot of people very rich. Life has been good for a lot of the giant stakeholders in medicine without transparency. That is starting to change.
Dr. Martin McCary is a professor of surgery at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, and I appreciate you coming on. Thank you.
Great to be with you, Dave.
Efforts to pass stricter gun laws, like raising the age limit to buy semi-automatic rifles, failed in the state legislature this year, but voters could have the final say if backers of an initiative can gather enough signatures over the next few weeks. Here's Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
Dave, after some legal challenges over the ballot title of I-1639 were settled by a Thurston County judge last week, backers of that initiative started an aggressive signature campaign under a very tight deadline. They need to turn in about 260,000 valid signatures by July 6th to get this initiative on the November ballot and have voters decide on whether to enact some pretty sweeping changes to our state's gun laws, especially concerning semi-automatic rifles such as AR-15s. Talman Trask is with the Alliance for Gun Responsibility, the group behind the statewide initiative.
And the goal here is really to make sure that our schools and our communities are safe from the kind of gun violence that terrorizes our country and even our state and city regularly and all too often. To do that, it does three really important interconnected things. Raise the age to purchase semi-automatic assault weapons in the state to 21 from the current age of 18. It'll create an enhanced background check for those weapons.
Much like the bill that failed in the legislature this past session, those enhanced background checks for semi-automatic rifles would mean putting the buyer through the same process you have to go through when you buy a handgun in our state, going through both a federal and state background check. Right now, people buying those rifles only have to go through the federal check to get those in our state. The third major component to this is a safe storage requirement, which creates criminal penalties for gun owners who do not safely store their weapons when they end up getting in the hands of the wrong people.
Between 2012 and 2015, a total of more than 33,000 firearms were stolen from individual gun owners in Washington. And that puts firearms into a black market and into dangerous hands and gives people access to guns that they just really shouldn't have in a really obvious way. And dangerous access prevention helps prevent that by helping incentivize secure storage practices, which limit theft opportunities. It also helps prevent school shootings. We know that the majority of school shooters access firearms in their homes or homes with their friends or family.
But Dave Workman with thegunmag.com says, not surprisingly, gun owners have a lot of concerns with this initiative.
I think the major concerns are that it denies Second Amendment rights, constitutional rights to people 18 to 20 years old or 18 to 21 years old. There's also a concern about the waiting periods, 10 days, a training requirement in order to exercise a constitutional right, and the creation of a statewide gun registry.
So that initiative allows for that 10-day waiting period. It also requires those buying semi-automatic rifles to go through a firearms training course. And the registry he refers to would be the result of a new document requirement for the sale of those guns that would be kept with the Department of Licensing, which gun rights folks argue is a de facto registry. Now, another aspect of this initiative, which I've not heard before, would require the Department of Licensing to set up a system within 1 year that allows for annual rechecks of people buying semi-automatic rifles to ensure they are still legally allowed to have those weapons they buy every year on an annual basis.
We don't want people who have restraining orders or who have established criminal histories after they've purchased these weapons to suddenly be allowed to hold on to them with no guarantee from the Department of Licensing that they're going to be prevented from accessing those weapons in the future. It's an important part of gun violence prevention to not only make sure that we're preventing people who are dangerous to themselves or others from purchasing guns, but also that we're reducing risk and access.
Among the other concerns on the gun rights side is the fact that this initiative is 30 pages long, very involved, and that people being asked to sign the petitions aren't getting a chance to read through that before they sign it. Workman says paid signature market this cycle is also causing some concerns with campaigns like this one and those behind the referendum effort to repeal the head tax that just wrapped up. Paying their signature gathers more than double what other efforts to get initiatives on the statewide ballot have been able to afford this session.
This is really a problem that I think is going to be developing not just this year, but in years ahead, where you're going to have to pay a lot of money to get signatures on a petition, because the petition signature gatherers will expect that kind of revenue. And it puts people with grassroots movements in a pretty tough position because they just can't raise that kind of money.
Hmm. Well, it's always been expensive to do initiatives, and nobody reads the initiatives before they sign them anyway. And how is this going to be enforced, the storage thing? That's what I think concerns a lot of people.
The safe storage thing, so the language in the initiative basically would be up. You know, the cops aren't going to come in and make sure that your guns are sourced. They're not going to be coming searching your house.
No.
But if you're, it's much like legislation that failed in the legislature this past session. If someone who is not allowed to have a weapon gets a hold of your weapon because you did not have it safely stored, then you're going to face, it can be anywhere from a misdemeanor to a felony, depending on what's done with
that. So that could be criminal.
That.
In other words, if
absolutely,
you lose control of your gun and that gun is used to kill somebody else, for example, you could wind up in jail.
Yeah, absolutely. Or if a kid gets a hold of it, accidentally shoots someone else, or even is walking around threatening with that, that's where you would get the levels between a misdemeanor and a felony. It depends on what it's used for. But then, absolutely.
Yeah,
I can't
say that's a bad idea. I don't know anybody, any responsible gun owner who thinks that people should be careless with their weapons.
No, and absolutely not. The one of the big concerns, and this is what came up when this was in the legislature, is that it would also, if somebody goes in your house and robs your weapon because it wasn't safely stored, that's where you could get that criminal penalty too. And some
I mean, if you have it in the safe and somebody takes a welding torch and cuts the lock off, you're not going to be jailed for that.
No. As long as it's safely stored, and there's various definitions. No, not one clear one that you need a gun safe or a trigger lock, things like that.
Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah. Here's one of the puzzle pieces we've been waiting for since November of 2016. It's a new report that indicates that James Comey, former director of the FBI, was apolitical in his investigation of Hillary Clinton, but insubordinate in the way he handled it. I talked about it with Face the Nation host Margaret Brennan.
This was in many ways a public rebuke of the fired FBI director for being insubordinate, as you say, meaning he didn't loop in fully the attorney general at the time, Loretta Lynch, on his decisions to go public with certain parts of the Clinton email investigation. Of course, both Democrats and Republicans have found fault with James Comey, saying that he put his finger on the scale when it came to the election so close to voting day. Republicans alleged somehow that he was helping Hillary Clinton in the actual investigation, even though the other side would say, certain Clinton supporters would say, that he really seemed to be putting his finger on the scale for President Trump. And the bottom line, at the end of the day, the FBI put out this statement yesterday saying that institutionally they're going to take a harder look at how some of these things are handled. The scrutiny is painful for them, but they ultimately found no political bias.
Okay, but that conclusion that Comey was insubordinate, isn't that the ball game? If if Robert Mueller tries to accuse him of obstruction of justice for firing James Comey, he can say, wait a minute, there's a report here saying that Comey was insubordinate. Employees are fired for insubordination all the time.
That's one of the points that will be made hay of politically, certainly. There's no clear vindication here, total vindication for either Democrats or Republicans, as I say, but that doesn't mean you can't use some of the pieces of this report to further your argument, right? You will see that not only with a June 25th hearing before the House Judiciary and Oversight Committees, as they pick apart some of these texts in particular sent by an FBI official talking about trying to prevent President Trump from ultimately winning. Obviously, that failed. But if you're a Trump supporter, you say that shows institutional bias against the president, and you look then forward towards the Mueller investigation. On the other side of it, as you point out, the president can now take this report and say, look, I was justified in firing James Comey. Why does that matter? Well, look, ultimately, it was that firing that led to the appointment of the special counsel to look into whether the president was trying to obstruct justice, that maybe he was motivated by something other, including influencing the outcome of the ongoing investigation into Russian election meddling. Frankly, I think for a large part of this country, it's all confusing, it's noise, and it's frustration that it looks like political games. When you look at the latest polling CBS has done, it does seem to show that people aren't tracking the details. They are just viewing it through a very partisan lens.
Right. I couldn't disagree with you there. On this issue of separating children at the border, this has now become a pretty hot-button issue. It was the subject of a pointed question at the White House briefing yesterday from, I guess, the reporter for Playboy, who said to Sarah Sanders, you have children. How can you possibly abide this? So what does the law say here? Is it, in fact, required by law that children of people who are seeking asylum be separated at the border from their parents?
Not explicitly as you just described it. What the Trump administration has adopted as their policy is to prosecute these illegal crossings of, you know, a parent and child or an individual into this country as criminal rather than civil proceedings. And when it comes to these criminal matters, if you shoot someone in the street and you have a kid, you're put in jail separated from your child. That's right. The argument that Jeff Sessions would make, that that's the same thing as crossing illegally into the country and that you should suffer the same consequences. Therefore, he's following the law. It's his policy to prosecute as a criminal matter. But what others would argue here, certainly Democrats, is to say, wait a second, this isn't a law. That this certainly wasn't an Obama administration way of doing things. And in fact, it's a choice that you are making here, that you could treat these family units differently if you so desired. And in fact, you are trying to do this as a deterrent. The reason you're separating is to scare people off from trying to cross in the first place. And some within the Trump administration have admitted they do believe this is a deterrent to scaring off people from taking the risk. Of course, for anyone fleeing, they have to make that choice of which of this very high risk, potentially high reward choice to make. What we are seeing is in this debate within particularly Republican circles on how to legislate around immigration, that there's now a proposal to put in place an actual law to stop the Trump administration from doing that. That's in the GOP compromise bill. The question is whether does this go anywhere before November? Is there ever going to be any kind of decision on immigration ahead of those congressional races? We'll talk about some of that with Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine on the show this Sunday.
Margaret Brennan, host of Face the Nation. She joins us every Friday. Eighteen past 7 o'clock, Seattle's morning news. It has taken 14 years, but the sequel to The Incredibles is out. So is this like Roseanne, where everybody is 14 years older and more crotchety?
No, it begins like the moment the first one ends, it picks up. So it picks up sort of like in the middle of an action scene at this point. But what's interesting about this is Incredibles, deservedly so, was an incredible, you know, smash hit at the time. In the intervening 14 years, a lot has changed. You've got to remember that sort of placement, the places, The Incredibles premiered before the whole Marvel Cinematic Universe exploded. Yeah. So before all the glut of Iron Mans and Captain Americas and the Avengers.
Back when it was fresh.
Exactly. And perhaps more significantly, Dave, it also premiered before a string of Pixar powerhouses like Up, Toy Story 3, Inside Out, Finding Dory, and Coco. Now, the reception to Incredibles 2 may be somewhat susceptible to that superhero fatigue we're looking at, but since the film's focus is really on the family dynamics, the Marvel specter really doesn't inhibit the reception of Incredibles 2 very much. However, I think its Pixar heritage may prove to be more problematic. So accustomed, at least I am, Dave, to expect recent Pixar films packing an emotional wallop, the fact that Incredibles 2 doesn't deliver on that score seems like something of a letdown, even though the original Incredibles never didn't have...
Were you expecting Inside Out or something?
I was expecting... Listen, the last five films have all brought tears to the eyes or have moved us emotionally, and we didn't expect Incredibles, the original, to do that because it hadn't really become a Pixar thing yet. But because that's there, it feels like it's slightly a letdown. Now, that's not really fair to Incredibles 2, but I think Pixar is suffering from its own success in that now we're expecting, we can have fun and games and family dynamics, and it'll move us, and it doesn't quite do that. That doesn't mean that it isn't a lot of fun and it's very entertaining. If you want to know what the basic plot is here, it picks up where the Incredibles are still in a kind of witness protection program where they have to hide their superhero talents. But a rich telecommunications mogul contacts them with a public relations plan to bring them out of the shadows once again.
It's time to make some wrong things right. Help me bring supers back into the sunlight. We need to change people's perceptions about superheroes. And Elastigirl is our best play.
Better than... me?
The fact
somebody has to launch a PR campaign to rehabilitate the reputation.
That's right. Say, hey, we need to bring our superheroes back. After all, they've got a lousy shot. If we put body cameras on them and showed how spectacular what they did, they would actually succeed. Yeah, they're going to put cameras on each of them. But the weird thing is, and the interesting thing for the film is, they decide our best bet is the wife. We're going to focus on Elastigirl, which creates a kind of strained family dynamic, obviously with the husband. So mom / Elastigirl is suddenly outperforming acts of heroism. Mr. Incredible finds himself playing Mr. Mom to his moody teenage daughter, his rambunctious son, and the baby Jack-Jack. And he's not a natural, of course, especially when it comes to homework.
That's not the way you're supposed to do it, Dad. They want us to do it.
I don't know that way. Why would they change math? Math is math.
Okay,
math,
Dad.
Is math.
And as fashion icon Edna Mode, yes, she does turn up again, tells Mr. Incredible.
Done properly, parenting is a heroic act. Done properly.
So it's this heroic act that this superhero, humorously, has a hard time mastering. Now, they do introduce a new villain in the movie. He's called Screenslaver, who hypnotizes everyone inside of a screen. It's a not-so-subtle critique of contemporary society. But the real fun of the movie, Dave, involves baby Jack-Jack, who discovers new and unforeseen powers almost every day. Without warning, he can breathe fire, teleport to different dimensions, clone himself into multiples, and shoot lasers out of his eyes. I'm not positive about this, but if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Incredible even warns his other kids to not let Jack-Jack shoot inside the house. If there's an Incredibles 3, I'd be surprised if Jack-Jack wasn't its featured star, all in the context of family, of course. Incredibles 2 doesn't have the sparkling freshness of the original Incredibles, nor the emotional power of the recent Pixar films, but it still delivers enough humor and action and insight to be, as they say, fun for the whole family.
Okay, so is the we seem to be just in a spate of superhero movies.
Yes.
Is this intentional or has it run its course? What do you think?
Well, the thing is, no, it hasn't run its course. The Marvel Universe has two more than they'll cap a 22-film universe. So you have another year's worth of this. Uh-huh. Then at that point, I think we'll all reassess where the Marvel Universe stands. The Pixar films are going to continue. I wouldn't be surprised, since this is a movie about family dynamics, that they'll eventually come up with an Incredibles 3, maybe focusing on Jack-Jack. That'll be that emotional wallop kind of Incredibles movie that I'm looking for.
So if you find yourself with the child who can shoot lasers from his eyes, you'll know
how to handle that. Yeah. Don't forget the teleporting.
And teleporting too.
And cloning. I mean, there's a whole new world out there, Dave.
So how many Tangs out of 4 for Incredibles 2?
By Pixar standards, I'm only giving it 3 Tangs.
3 Tangs out of 4 for Incredibles 2. There's a lot of numbers there. Thank you, Tom. Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Here he is, Danny O'Neill. Who's your little friend?
My little friend is Peach. She's a dreamer. She came over here from Korea. Uh-huh. We adopted her about 5 years ago.
Dreamer?
Yeah, exactly right. The Peach. But she's kind of in it. She's a little bit of a Muppet. She's a Sharpay.
I hope people can hear her snorting.
Yeah.
She's
got some breathing problems.
She loves your ankles for some reason.
Yeah, we moved. Well, that's because I'm not giving her a very wide berth in here, Dave.
You smear bacon on them?
Yeah, exactly. No, they just smell that way naturally.
I'm posting a picture to Twitter right now.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
The Mariners could not quite pull one out, but I saw the commentary that it was considered a moral victory, at least for Felix Hernandez.
Felix pitched really well. And Felix was pumped up and involved in the game, and that's the best hitting team in baseball. And he allowed 2 runs. Unfortunately, the second of those runs was pretty unnecessary. He ended up getting a double play earlier in the inning, was really pumped up, and then he ended up leaving a fastball up, which he should not have done. But he pitched well, and I thought he competed really well. And you now look at it, 2 of his past 3 starts have been really good. So that was encouraging. And also, the one run win, we've enjoyed many of those. Mm-hmm. You're right. Going to suffer a couple of them. They were in it till the end. They were in it till the end, and they stood toe to toe with the team. They should have an advantage tonight. Paxton going against Rick Porcello, and Porcello's a former Cy Young Award winner, but Paxton's having the better season. Let's see the Mariners get it back tonight.
You think so? Because they're hosting the Red Sox all weekend, correct?
Correct. 4-game series. You want to go 2-2 at home against the team that you're going to kind of measure yourself. You want to go 2-2. 3-1. At this point would be extremely difficult, would have been a huge, huge statement. But 2-2 against the Red Sox, you feel pretty good about that.
What is this team shaping up to be?
A well-rounded team with one of the longest lineups in the league and starting pitching that's been way better than anyone thought, mm-hmm. but doesn't have much depth. Like, that's the survey of it, is that we underestimated how good this lineup is going to be 1 through 9.
I think so. I remember us talking pretty negatively at the beginning of the season, and I'm sort of, you know, regretting that a little.
And a big part is because the hitters 6 through 9 have been really productive. It's not because, and Kyle Seager had a tough night last night, not defensively, but at the plate. And you really should be getting more from him than you are. He had a strikeout in the 9th inning, which was really tough when you had the tying run in scoring position. But you feel good about the production you're getting from the lineup. And the pitching, you're just holding your breath and hoping it holds on.
Yeah.
The commissioner of baseball, whose name I learned is Rob Manfred. Last commissioner, his name I recognized was Bowie Kuhn. Is that a long time ago?
That is quite a ways ago. Yes.
Anyway, Rob Manfred is thinking about enforcing the DH, the designated hitter rule, on both leagues.
Yeah, he's talking about doing it in the National League as well. I hate this idea. I hate it for this simple reason. It's an overreaction to what happened to the poor little Yankees, because Masahiro Tanaka, one of their starting pitchers, managed to strain both hamstrings while running the bases during interleague play. So now everybody's like, oh man, our pitcher gets hurt. Why do pitchers even have to hit and run the bases? That's not a very big ask for a professional athlete to be able to run the bases without straining both hamstrings. And so now it's like they're going to take it away. Look, I'm traditionally have preferred the National League style of play with pitchers who hit, because you shouldn't give an exemption. Like in football, we don't, oh, this guy can't block, so we'll give you a special exemption to replace him in that part of the game.
And you want to see more Ohtani-type players emerge, don't you?
Sure, and there's something to the fact that the leagues play differently. The counter-argument is no one wants to watch pitchers hit. No one. And there's not a great argument against that, because it's not very fun and they're terrible.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I don't pitchers. Know. I feel like I like seeing multi-talented people. I like seeing somebody. But if you say most of them don't work out, then I guess.
They're terrible hitters. Mm. I mean, the best hitting pitcher right now, besides Ohtani, who doesn't hit on the days he pitches, by the way, the best one is probably Madison Bumgarner. And he probably would not make an everyday lineup as a hitter. At least not without some
time.
That is
one of my early childhood memories. The one Yankees game I went to, and growing up in New York, where Dad took me, was Yankees against Kansas City. And I just remember how amazed he was when the Kansas City pitcher strolled up to the plate and hit a home run.
Yeah.
So
Felix had a grand slam. Did you want to take away that joy? I think he closed his eyes when he hit it.
Yeah.
But he hit a grand slam. He did it.
Closed his eyes. It gives it extra power. Can I ask about the Seahawks? The minicamp wrapped up. What did we get from it?
We got that they're going to be a dramatically new team, especially on defense. And we're going to learn a lot about their personality. And this is going to be, whether it's rebuilding or whether they're able to improve from last season, is going to depend upon whether these young players, whom we don't know yet, are able to exceed expectations. Can Pete Carroll do it again? Can they get a defense that goes to the top of the league with a cast of guys that people haven't really heard of? Because that's what they have.
I know how you feel about umpires. Did you see this tape between the Mets manager Terry Collins and umpire Tom Hallion?
Yes, who was behind the plate earlier in this series against
was he?
Yeah, he was. He's calling balls and strikes in the last series against the Angels.
Okay, well, this was from 2016. For some reason, they had mic'd them both up, I guess. We can't play much of it because it sort of degenerates into obscenity. But can you set this up, what they were arguing about?
The pitcher. And I believe it's Syndergaard, has been thrown out of the game for throwing a pitch behind the hitter, which is a retaliation. It's Chase Utley who's at the plate, and it's a retaliation for something that had happened in a playoff series previously. Utley had injured one of the Mets players.
Okay, here it is.
Terry, get a handle. Come on, let's go. Come on, talk. Then you talk to me about that.
You got to give us a shot.
You got to give us a shot.
Which is, you've got to give us a chance to get revenge, is really what Terry Collins
is. So that really
is
the thing. See, I've had trouble believing this, that these little revenge dramas play out in front of thousands of fans in a baseball stadium.
And everybody knows what's happening. And in that case, the umpire said, we see exactly what's going on, and you're out of here. And then Syndergaard's like, what? Why can't I throw at his head? And Collins is basically saying, you've got to give us a chance to hit him for what he did. You've got to do it. And the umpire repeatedly says to him, it's our butts in the jackpot. It's our butts in the jackpot. We all know what's going on. It's our butts in the jackpot. It's pretty funny because you hear them speaking, and Collins has lost his mind. And Hallion had gone and run to intercept him before he got to the home plate umpire to try and tell him, you can't go this nuts. You've got to stop. And then they just basically scream at each other for a little bit. I don't know if the ump did his job or not, because there's part of me that's like, well, he's kind of trying to denuclearize. Well, wait, that might be a touchy subject. He's trying to keep this from going over the top, yet we all kind of like it when the manager goes over the top.
I want to hear more of that. That was great. Thank you, Danny.
You want to hear more bleeping?
No, I want to hear more of these arguments. So I'm sorry about the bleeping. Frankly, I don't think it would have upset anybody, but
I don't know, man.
You have to do it.
I definitely that was profane, and I don't have delicate ears.
I thought it was all just, you know, made up Sturm und Drang, but they were really into it, and it was truth. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you
soon. Sports Insider, Western Washington Toyota Dealers.